CliffCentral.com.
Welcome back, Adrian Groenewald and Louis Groenewald with you. It's wonderful, the conversation we just had. I hope you absorbed it, about HashALC, such an important initiative that we launched to get the authentic leadership community to have conversations. We've got on the line now, and our conversation is going to be, but before I say that, with some meetings today with some leaders, I just realized again, Louis, they are under such pressure, leaders. And I think our guest now would know all about that personally, but also the kind of leaders she deals with. But that's my sense, Louis. Leaders are under incredible pressure. We have to find ways, techniques, methods that help them cope in today's crazy world.
I think, Arjun, really, after today's session with several leaders, that if there's a pattern emerging, is the fact that leaders do increasingly feel under pressure of modern expectations. I suppose it's clearly because of social media and the number of stakeholders that seem to be interested in every leader seems to have increased dramatically. So they are under pressure. They really are, and their performance are dramatically affected by that.
So Debbie Goodman Byatt, she wrote a book, In the Flow, Taking Mindfulness to Work, Becoming More Aware, Self-Aware, and much more than that. But of course, also the CEO and founder of Jack Hammer. It's a top executive search firm, and she's been doing this for many years, which means it's not just only her life that is very tense and pressure-filled and has been for many years, but also the people she deals with. So she speaks from authenticity. But we want to look at this book. We want to look at the impact it's had on her leadership style, her leadership approach, her team, and maybe even other teams beyond her own. Debbie, welcome to Leadership Transformation Platform.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
All the way from Cape Town, you just returned from somewhere overseas, and we're really happy to have you. I must tell you, last night I was thinking ahead to today, what am I excited about? And this was one of the things for sure that popped out, the fact that I was excited to meet with you, especially as I got deeper and deeper into your book. And I think our listeners, our leaders will know very soon why. But you will understand, I was excited about this interview.
Great, I'm excited too. Let's get going.
But when you sat yesterday and you thought about today, was this one of the things you were excited about?
Frankly, yesterday I had just landed from a conference that took place in Europe, and the trip back was took about 26 hours. Ooh, so so far it's one day at a time. Right now, I'm really pleased to be here and very excited to share with you some of the insights and learnings and what it's all about. I think mindfulness in general is a practice and a concept and an idea that's taken into practice that's gaining lots more popularity. I suppose people are finding it not quite as esoteric as they might have thought it was. Mm. And so it's I'm very keen to share some of the mindfulness based ideas and practices that I use for myself personally and in my work environment.
I'm extracting a quote from your book, but it kind of comes down to your job and your business and your everyday life before we look at the detail in the book or some concepts in the book or principles. You said, in 2012, I was working so hard at trying to ensure that the balls were all moving in perfect synchronization that I was not only exhausted but also quite miserable and definitely not having any fun at all. I wonder how many executives are in this position, if they are really honest with themselves. And as you engage them, what are you finding? Less happiness at work than 10, 20, 50 years ago?
Look, I think that the world is fast and more complex than it's ever been, and it's gaining additional momentum by the day, complexity by the day. And as human beings, our brains crave certainty. And so the fact that there is so little of that, regardless of the specific circumstances that we find ourselves in, means that it's sometimes really, really tough to cope. Certainly that's where I found myself a few years ago. But I think the kinds of executives and leaders that I'm engaging with on a daily basis, as well as almost anybody living, a human being, is just faced with kind of complexity that was unimaginable a while ago. And so, and people are really trying to figure out just how to cope, trying to be something other than what they are right now. I think there's also, you mentioned something around happiness at work, and I think that, or happiness in general, and I think that I compare the happiness industry, in inverted commas, almost a bit to like the diet industry. It's an industry that's worth millions and billions of dollars worldwide, and we're almost indoctrinated to believe that happiness is this we're on this eternal quest to feel constantly and consistently happy, and there's tremendous pressure all around to be something that we aren't. And that in itself, just the idea that if we're stressed out, if we're anxious, if we're just not coping, that that is, that there's something wrong with that, that in itself adds more pressure. And so I'm a little, anti the happiness at work, happiness in life. I mean, listen, we all want to know, nobody wants to lead a miserable life, but, the idea that happiness is this elusive holy grail is something that I think can lead us off course.
But I'm willing to bet that in 2012, when you felt these feelings, and maybe on and off before that, people around you were just looking at you from an external point of view, saying she's successful, she's running around, busy schedule, earning, growing a business, meeting top leaders. Wow, you know, that's the life. But inside, you were kind of dying.
Yeah, and I think that that's the external view versus the internal view. And I think it's something that's shared amongst people who are expected to be leaders. They're expected to operate in a certain way. They're expected to have a certain level of energy. There's a lot of expectation. And people feel the pressure to fulfill that expectation. So I suppose at that point, if I had said to anybody around me, listen, I'm just, life's horrible right now. I'm miserable. I'm exhausted and I'm uncertain and I'm just not having any fun. They would have looked at me like, what are you saying? Look at this beautiful, perfect life of yours. You're the CEO of a business. Your business is successful. You've got a beautiful family. You've got an amazing husband. You've got two gorgeous kids. You live in a beautiful home. You travel. I mean, the list, if you want to put the list down, the list is endless of wonderful things that are happening, but that's all external stuff. And to the outside, it may look like it's just totally perfect. The point is that when there is too much going on, when there is too much expectation, when you're just constantly on this treadmill of having so much in the air that you feel the compulsion to that it's all got to work perfectly, the internal pressure builds up to the point that it's really hard to feel happy and joyful about everyday life.
Those expectations are also more visible than ever, aren't they? I mean, in today's world, all those expectations are just in your face. I think of top actresses and actors. People wonder, why are they so in the dumps and drug addicts and just in general unhappy when they have everything, the world at their feet? But I think it's the same principle that you're expressing now, that conflict between what I'm experiencing inside versus the outside perception. And then that places more pressure on me because the perception is I'm happy and I have everything. What's wrong with me? Why don't I feel it? But there's a reason why you're not feeling it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really I got to the point where I realized that my model wasn't working. My model for life wasn't working. It might have looked like it was working, but the only person who could really verify that was me. And my internal state was an indication that that was just no longer sustainable, really. And that's the point where I started doing a lot of research and a lot of reading and a lot of questioning that I hadn't previously done. I hadn't felt the need to do that. You know, everybody, I think it's common knowledge. One one is ready for change when you reach a point of pain usually. So I started seeking out a different way. I think I was it was probably it coincided with a bit of a midlife crisis. So I must have been in my early 40s at the time. My thought was, what got me here isn't going to take me there. The way I've lived my last 40 isn't the way I'm going to live my next 40. And I'm not sure what that new way looks like. And so it was a process of searching. And also almost rediscovering things that that had already been introduced to me, but I hadn't really been ready to look at them properly. One of them being mindfulness. I had been very reluctant and resistant to even consider the concept of meditation at all, because for me, I'm a doer, and I couldn't understand this whole meditation thing. Like, what do you do? And then the dogma around, well, what you don't actually do anything, you just be. And I just couldn't get that either. Like, what does being mean? I mean, you're alive, so you're being, right? And so it was incredible. It was really frustrating because I couldn't make sense of the language. I couldn't make sense of the process. But, you know, I think there's enough memes out there to say when you're ready, the opportunities appear. And so I was ready at that point, late 2012, early 2013, to say, okay, I'm going to try something different. And I read it was really probably my most life-changing book by Mark Williams and Danny Penman called Mindfulness, Finding Peace in a Frantic World. And I started reading it on a flight from Cape Town to Johannesburg. And by the time I'd landed, I'd already completed my first basic mindfulness meditation. And I then embarked on an 8-week program, which was self-guided together with audio guides, et cetera. And I really started to feel some changes quite quickly. And that combined with a whole lot of other reading and exploration and research that I was doing, I started trying out and put it this way. I realized that meaningful change can only happen if you start doing something differently on a ritualized basis. So how do you form a new habit? And I also realized that whilst it was very nice to meditate for 20 minutes every morning, the moment I had finished that, it was like straight back to the hardwiring, the autopilot of life.
Things start going down.
To all the different variables that that were in any event taking place. And so whilst mindfulness itself is a tremendous tool, and I mean, if you really go into the research, the list of benefits is endless. I mean, we haven't got time to talk about all of that.
No.
But what I needed was to apply some of those principles to my normal everyday life. And out of that is really where the prompts that formulated the system that I designed in the flow came. And so I always hasten to tell people, you know, I'm not a mindfulness expert. I'm no guru. I'm no spiritual person. I'm no practitioner. I'm not a clinician. I'm not a mindfulness expert in any stretch of the imagination. All I've done really is I've tried to understand what those principles are that worked for me and then apply those in a way that's quite accessible.
Yeah, I mean, you've kind of adapted it to your own life. You seem to have come up with, for lack of a better word, your own model. But I want to know why the book. All this led to the book, all right, In the Flow, which you've now published.
Mm.
But why the book? Are you trying to change the work environment? Are you trying to help leaders? Is it just a natural extension of the process you went through or the evolution you went through? Why the book?
Lots of people ask why the book. It's actually a really great question because it's not my gig, okay? I'm not really an author. I've spent 4 years writing a book, which I managed to do. It took a really long time. I think I rewrote it at least 5 times. So the thing is that I have been inspired throughout my life by other people's work and creativity. And I've taken little bits from here and there. I've been a student of leadership and new ways of leading since the first time I started with my own business. I have been fascinated by trying new approaches. I've looked back at the books that I was reading and buying way back then, and I see how now, 10, 15 years later, how some of those influenced a lot of my ideas and practices around the kind of leader I want to be and am becoming. And so when I designed In the Flow and I tried it out for myself, I then introduced it to my team. And over several years of practicing this ritual with my team, when I say ritual, let's not get all like esoteric here. Let's call it a tool. Trying that out, I realized that I had an incredibly valuable case study, a almost 4-year case study of using mindfulness-based ideas in the work environment that had some very unintended but unbelievably positive outcomes and consequences that I felt, you know something, I've benefited from other people's creativity and ideas. I kind of need to pay that forward. Okay. So I labored over years to finally get something that I was happy enough with to be brave enough to try and find a publisher that was willing to publish, because this is not mainstream stuff. And so, so that was really the reason.
So a book is one of the ways for you to pay forward. And just now I'll ask you what that pay forward has meant to you, because maybe it'll take you away from being a headhunter to working with businesses. But there's a quote I like: "In the flow has the capacity to enhance the way we perceive and experience our lives, the way we work as teams, and as a result, our overall productivity and levels of performance." So that's a bold statement, and you do bring that out in the book, saying, okay, yeah, this is not about making money, but yeah, our turnover increased, our productivity did, our happiness at work, or whatever it is. So this had a real impact on your people. There's two parts to the book: cultivating self-awareness and then transforming team culture. So, you know, if you have a team of self-aware people, and in the way that you position it, then that will no doubt go a long way towards transforming the team culture. But just take a minute. Why in that? So self-aware. You've spoken a bit about it, but just what will we find in the book regarding self-awareness as a sort of an overview?
So I think first of all, self-awareness as a general capability or trait is the key fundamental for leadership. And ultimately, we all are leaders in our lives. But for me, the kind of self-awareness that I'm talking about is an awareness of the present, an awareness of the now, an awareness of the reality and the truth as it appears to you in your life, an awareness of the moments that are meaningful, but that often are unnoticed. They often just we pass by them, because we're not paying enough attention. And so what the practice does is it consists of prompts to help one in one's everyday life to just start to pay attention. And by paying attention, you start to focus or shine a spotlight on things that are already in your life. There's nothing new necessarily. It's not about creating or generating new activity or more things on your to-do list. Not at all. Quite the opposite. It's about taking a moment to actually notice what's already there in order to bring that to awareness, in order to have a different perspective or a different experience of what's actually going on in your life. And so it's a self-awareness, awareness of one's life. It's an awareness and a noticing of small ordinary things, actually. The things that don't get a lot of media or airtime in your life, if you think of your life as your broadcaster. It's through these devices, really starting to shift your labeling of what your life is all about, how the day is going, And I share many examples of both in my personal experience as well as within my team and other businesses that I've shared this with around how people have, by using these mechanisms, they're so simple, have all of a sudden just changed their view on what their day was like, changed their view on what their life is like, changed their view on who they are. And so that's the element of self-awareness that I talk about.
If I can come in here very quickly, just let me just jump in. And I want Louis to also come in here because you talk of self-aware so strongly there. But as I go through it, I see a lot of other aware. So part of your prompts even, and I don't know if we'll mention the prompts here, but certainly they affected my day today. Not by no means saying I'm a fast learner or that it's already changed my life in one day or anything like that. But it's been on my mind all day long, those prompts. And I just read through it fairly fast last night. But the prompts were very other aware. Some of them are not just about me. It's actually about being aware of others. And Louis, I don't know, and you can come in now, Debbie, but I just want to ask Louis, if I want to become more self-aware, why would some of the prompts to help me become self-aware actually be about being aware of others, if that makes sense?
I think, Arjun, it makes obvious sense. You were discussing those prompts with me and Nicole in between visits to some leaders out there. And I feel it makes perfect sense. All the experience I've gained over my long old age indicates that if you're not aware of yourself and others and every single thing around you, then you're living a much poorer life. I love the way that Debbie expresses it. And from what you told me about the book, Arjun, I've just glanced at it. I think it makes a valuable contribution to a person, to self-understanding, and therefore to realizing our tremendous potential, all of us.
And what comes through very strongly, Debbie, is the power of gratitude, of being grateful, how that changes your life. I mean, that is the difference between really great people and not so great people very often, is that they're aware of things and they're grateful for so many things around them. That the power of gratitude.
Yes. So I fear a little sometimes that there's been so much said about gratitude that it's almost become a little tiring, a little over highlighted, if one could ever do that. And so what and there is so much research on the power of gratitude. There is, I mean, if you walk into any bookstore, you will find at least 3 or 4 fantastically well-researched books on the power of gratitude and how that actually influences, it can influence your life. The way that I always try to apply these ideas is to take them into like really basic, practical day-to-day, experiences. And so the tagline of the book is the power of noticing the small stuff. And so once again, with gratitude, we tend to think about the big stuff. Of course, we want to feel grateful for our families and our health and our et cetera, et cetera. The roof over our head, the food we have to eat. For me, it's about going, okay, I need to think a little bit about what's going on in my day right now and bring awareness to who am I really feeling grateful towards? What am I really feeling appreciative of? And to pick out something that's kind of really ordinary and very practical. And that's the thinking part. The incredible part, and you're right when I say it, when you say it, sometimes there's it's more than just a thinking or a self-awareness, it's an interaction with others. This gets real power when one is willing to actually take that into action. And if the gratitude or appreciation involves another human being, to actually communicate that, to actually share that, to actually acknowledge that. And it's when people do that, certainly when I do that, when I have noticed something that I would maybe have taken completely for granted, and instead say, hey, I'm feeling like very grateful for that. And then actually send a message, even if it's a WhatsApp, maybe even a call, to say, you know, I didn't thank you, or I didn't acknowledge you, but now I am. There's something tremendous that happens in that connection And I think that that's really where the second part of the book comes into in the team environment, is it's partly around individual self-awareness, but there's something else around the communication part of the of in the flow. And it's less about the specifics and more about the actual communication tool, the sharing. Because what we also know about human beings is that in this era, we're more and more alone, actually. We think we're more connected, yeah. But we're communicating authentically less and less. And so with this exercise, it's an incredible way to get people in a team to actually share tiny little bite-sized stories about what's going on in their personal or work lives with one another. And what happens in that connection is it builds trust, it builds understanding, it builds empathy, it builds compassion. And it's really that is the transformative angle of this process. And so I suppose that's an entirely different conversation. But when we're talking, if you just relate it back to the leadership angle, if we're wanting people who feel that they can be whole human beings, who feel that there is a connection amongst their peers where they feel understood and where they feel trusted and when they feel they can trust, that is extraordinarily powerful. If you really want to look at the link between a mindfulness-based tool and ultimate productivity, it's partly around the individual self-awareness, but it's primarily around an environment that's cultivated tremendous trust, because that's when people can really operate to their fullest potential.
I just want to say to people when they listen to this conversation that there's a simplicity in the book that is very powerful. I think partly because it's true, okay, so that's the one thing. Partly because it's been tested, and more as you head forward with this, Debbie, no doubt it's being tested more and more in other environments. But I could even tell you what those six things are. No one must think that, okay, I got it. You've got to read it. Because it does a simple thing, for example, just thinking, boy, I'm grateful for a very valuable conversation yesterday with my wife. You take it to the next level, saying, well, take that gratitude to the next level and actually let her know that you are grateful for it. And that takes that principle. And every principle that you've got here, you take to another level in a very simple form. Something that jumped out at me was, and I want to ask you, what is your leadership philosophy you subscribe to? For example, in the book, you mentioned compassionate leadership. Is that if someone said, what is your leadership philosophy by name? You know, people say servant leadership or whatever, authentic leadership, which maybe covers all of those. Would you say that's what you subscribe to, compassionate leadership?
It's partly compassionate leadership, and that in itself is exactly what is that, because I'm also the most results-driven. I mean, the one adjective that people use most to describe me is hardcore. So that doesn't sit so well with compassionate in the traditional view of what are those, what does that actually mean? I think that my leadership philosophy incorporates compassion and also incorporates a philosophy around self-management. And in order to have an environment where people are able to self-organize, where they don't require somebody to police, where they don't require somebody else to treat them like a child, where everybody is in actual fact an adult, where you have an adult organization because people step up to their responsibilities and take accountability. That is also part of my leadership philosophy. I don't manage and I don't performance manage. And in fact, if anybody in my team who works with me requires that, then that's a very good reason for them to not be part of my organization. Because it forces me to be the kind of leader that I did not sign up to be and do not want to be. And so that places huge responsibility on the collective. It places responsibility on everybody to step up and to take accountability. And when you have an environment like that, one can then have an overlay around compassionate leadership, which is around a knowing and understanding as opposed to a a softly, softly sympathy. That's not my style at all. But it's also about acknowledging that, that people have got whole lives and it's not just about work. And so knowing what's happening in each person's life and how that impacts their work environment, is another element that feeds into my leadership style.
Yeah.
So I would struggle actually with a one label. It encompasses, I suppose, several ideas and philosophies, mostly around the fact that I want to lead. I don't want to be a policeman.
Yeah. You can't run a headhunting firm or executive search firm and call CEOs and say, hey, I've got a job for you, and convince them to, if I can put it that way in very simplistic terms, to move from one very good job to the next one. If you're not very strong, very dynamic, very forceful, maybe very assertive, very confident, you've got to have all those elements to do what you do and to have achieved what you achieved. But this model, this process, In the Flow, the book that you wrote, has brought out the ability to enjoy your life along this high-powered, busy lifestyle that you've led. And therefore, I think the research project with your team over a couple of years, which in the book you say you have performed better, and it has impacted all kinds of elements in. It's a real experiment, that one. Are you doing more of this out there? In other words, in the past you were just doing executive search and whatever else goes around those business models in society, but are you being called upon to implement these principles like you did with your team in other businesses? Is that happening?
So I am doing a lot more keynote speaking and introducing of these kinds of, I'd say, new leadership styles to other organizations, to other leadership teams. It's a little separate from the work of executive search, and they're interrelated. If I talk about Jack Hammer and the executive search business, our job is to find great leaders. This work that I do in the leadership space is around helping people become great leaders. And so they're absolutely interrelated, but slightly separate. I think that so I'm involved in designing a new executive education course at the moment, which I'll be leading through one of the private tertiary institutions, because the mindfulness-based ideas in an adapted form doesn't really exist yet in South Africa. There are there's a master's in mindfulness that one can do through University of Stellenbosch. There are other more purist mindfulness-based programs that are very available and highly recommended in this country. But in terms of adapting the ideas in a practical, accessible way for professionals who might not be quite as ready to jump into full-blown pure mindfulness, is not something that exists. And so I'm busy designing a program around that. And then speaking to leadership teams who are starting to embrace the fact that the way of the future cannot be the same as the way things are now.
Yeah.
And we really need to be a lot more open to considering alternative ways of being. If we're to survive the pace and the chaos and the complexity of our world.
All right. Now, as we wrap up here, and we'll ask now where people can get the book, I thought I'd mention the six things, and you probably wouldn't have minded, but I'm not going to. They are very simple, very powerful. I just want to know, are you doing it every day still? Do you wake up and do this? Do you do it during the day? Are you really still practicing this yourself and in your business? Are you attempting to do this all the time? Is it part of your culture now?
My business has been, my team has been practicing this exercise in the flow for 4 years, and where are we now? April. 3.5 months. So count the days. They have not missed a day in that long, and it's not because of me. This is not something that I police. Once again, I don't. It consistently evolves. We talk about new ideas that we're going to consider or think about. We have one meeting a week on a Monday morning, so we propose new ideas to keep things fresh. But as a collective, they self-drive this because they have great value out of it. I personally, I meditate almost every day, and I do this as a self-practice almost every day. But as a team, it's part of the day. It feels weird to have a day when you don't connect with your teammates through this technology. And the incredible thing about it is I know that no matter how wonderful a new idea is that you introduce to your team, if people don't actually experience value out of it, it will soon die.
Yeah.
It'll end. Mm. Unless there's a really big incentive or really big punishment. None of those exist. So 4 years and 4 months is quite a long time.
Yeah, and those incentives and punishments only last so long while the leader's there and policing. Then it happens. Well, Debbie, I just want to ask Louis, any comments, questions before we close the conversation? Interesting principles, simple book, not long, not thick, not... You know, you can read it on an aeroplane to Cape Town and be touched by it. I think that's my personal view. Louis?
Debbie, thank you. I think your contribution is significant. I just want to mention, in all our years of contact with leaders, especially recently, there's a growing awareness of the need for leaders to be authentic only when they can come to terms with their inner self, the inner peace. So I think you are making a very important contribution there. Thanks, sir, Debbie.
So, Debbie,
great, thank you.
Where will the book be? I know it's, you tell us.
So, it is an exclusive book, but I think the easiest way of accessing it is on online. So, you can buy it on Amazon, take a lot, and then through the publisher themselves, Knowledge Resources. Also, you'll find all of those links on my personal website, which is debbiegoodmanbyatt.com. And all the links to purchase the book, and then it'll just be delivered to you. It's probably the easiest, without having to even get into traffic. So I'd recommend that. Debbie Goodman Byatt is the spelling of my name with no hyphens.
All right, Debbie Goodman Byatt, the book In the Flow, CEO, founder of Jackhammer Executive Search Firm. And yeah, thank you, Debbie, for contributing to the authentic leadership IP in the world, not just this conversation, but your book, for doing more than just running your business and finding good leaders, as you say. That's another conversation I'd love to have at some stage. There are fewer and fewer of them out there, strangely. But you know, I think putting ourselves out there and writing a book when it's not your natural thing to do, it just shows that you want to take it one step further, and we thank you for that. And thank you for joining us.
Great. Thank you. It's been a lovely discussion.
All the best, Debbie. We'll be in touch. And that was Debbie, as I said, Debbie Goodman Byatt from Jackhammer. And go get the book, In the Flow, Taking Mindfulness to Work. Next up, our Business Masterclass with Richard Angus and the team. Thank you for joining us. That's Adrian and Louis. Over and out. CliffCentral.com.